This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm News Director Sarah Bohannon. Today we're staying focused on food insecurity and hunger in the Campfire Burn Scar, with the next two episodes in this series highlighting those who are working to help survivors make ends meet. We're going to travel all over the Burn Scar, but today we're focusing on Paradise and Magalia. If you have questions or comments for us, leave them on our message line 433-9216. For Wednesday, July 1st, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. First, the latest on COVID-19.
For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert. All bars, restaurants, wineries, card rooms in Glenn and 18 other counties were ordered closed immediately Wednesday by Governor Gavin Newsom as COVID-19 infections spire higher alarmingly in some parts of California. The rest of the counties under the order are mostly in Southern California and the San Joaquin Valley and covered nearly three-quarters of state residents. Newsom said the state's test positivity rate had risen to 6% from just over 4.5% a week ago, calling it a serious concern. Counties forced to reinstate restrictions have even higher rates. Glenn County's is just shy of 19%, meaning nearly 1 in 5 tested is already infected with COVID-19. Clusters of infections are active and appear to be spreading quickly in parts of the North State. Public health officials across the 11-county region were reporting 878 cases Wednesday afternoon. Cases have been quickly multiplying in recent days. According to the most recent data available, Sutter County health officials had confirmed 190 cases, Butte County 189, Shasta 118, Glenn 112, Tehama 78, Yuba 75, Colusa 59, Siskiyou 31, Lassen 14, Plumas 10, and Trinity County 2. Across the region, 21 people are being treated in hospitals, 11 have died. Statewide, 222,917 Californians have contracted the virus. 6,367 more cases were confirmed Tuesday, the most recent data available. Infections are increasing by 22% per week, suggesting the pandemic is spreading more rapidly. In contrast, the number of fatalities rose by a much slower 7% compared to last week. A total of 44 coronavirus-related deaths were recorded Tuesday, pushing the total in California to 5,980. 400 people have died over the past week. Making it harder for people to gather during the July 4th holiday, the governor also ordered the state park system to close all beach parking lots in the Bay Area and Southern California through the weekend. Newsom also again pleaded with Californians to wear face masks, acknowledging that the mandate isn't generally being enforced.
Just because someone's not going to tap you and write a citation doesn't mean you shouldn't do the right thing. We know better. We were taught better. And that's what our grandparents and parents taught us, just to respect others, even if we're not going to respect ourselves. And again, wearing a face covering is a sign of toughness. It's a sign of resolve, a sign of someone who gives a damn. It's a sign of someone who wants to solve a problem.
Hours before a prohibition on evictions was set to expire, Newsom extended the order through the end of September. It's not a statewide ban, however. The order enables elected leaders in each of the state's 58 counties to decide whether or not to prohibit evictions. Other changes, such as allowing marriage ceremonies via conference call and removing red tape from Medi-Cal and Cal Works, along with operational changes at the Department of Motor Vehicles, were also extended through the end of September. For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert.
This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. In our last episode of this series, we heard from campfire survivors about what they've been experiencing with food access and food insecurity in the Burn Scar. In these next two episodes, we're going to focus on the organizations that are trying to help. Today, specifically on those working in Paradise and on the Upper Ridge. To learn about what they're seeing in their work, about the barriers that they are facing, as well as what's making a difference. Youth for Change is a community-based nonprofit from Paradise that supports families and campfire survivors by connecting them to resources and providing them with food. Beth Parsons is the organization's chief executive officer. She recently spoke with NSPR's Christian Solis, who first asked her to describe the current state of food insecurity in the Burn Scar now that it's been more than a year and a half after the fire.
Fortunately, especially in the Upper Ridge, there is still an insecurity even 18 months after the fire. You would think, you know, if you're not from this area, people lose sight of how devastating the fire was and how much we lost, especially for our vulnerable populations. There were a lot of unusual living situations that are now gone that made it affordable for people to live on low incomes in the area. Those vulnerable populations are greatly affected because it was so severe. The recovery is very slow. So, for example, as an organization, we were fully insured and we're just now to the point where we could even consider moving forward on some of our property. So it's really difficult to think about what that population and what those people are doing when they don't have all of those resources behind them. You know, many are still just trying to get basic needs, food, electricity. Many are still living off of generators and don't have power. It's a very difficult situation.
How has the pandemic impacted food insecurity and food recovery efforts?
The pandemic has definitely affected, again, our youth and families. We do serve what's called transitional age youth. And I think just about every one of those youth that we serve has lost their job during this pandemic. So, you know, a group of people that are just getting started on their own, probably the first time that they've been out of foster care, or maybe they're moving in from our 6th Street Center that serves homeless youth. They're in a fragile state anyway, and then to have lost the little bit of hope that they've gotten started and rebuilt their lives. We've been taking food, toilet paper, everything that they need because their lives have been completely disrupted again.
What are the barriers to increasing food access and food security?
That's a big question. and a big question, I mean, it's a very big challenge to solve because there are so many interrelated pieces. You know, it goes to everything from the types of housing and affordable housing not be available in the area that was available in the burn scar pre-campfire. It's losing some of the businesses and stores and different things up in the area. So you don't have very many choices when you do want to go shopping or can go shopping. Programs keep changing. You know, maybe one program is offering food and they can do it for 6 months, but then funding runs out or changes. And so then there's a gap, you know, then another one usually steps in, but it's just very difficult to get that consistency of help that is needed in the area. There are so many different situations in the burn scar that you wouldn't expect. And everybody's in a different place. And, you know, the rolling backouts, the pandemic, job loss again after the campfire, people that were just starting to get going again have now, you know, been moved back to square one or even further behind.
What do you think people misunderstand about campfire recovery?
I do think that when you're not living it, for example, if I'm with a group of people that is not from the area, they don't understand that a year and a half later, how you could still be grappling with a fire. You know, it seems like to them it should be a distant memory. It's over with. But there's so much work to be done in the rebuild. It's a daily, I know I'm still dealing with it, with the ramifications and issues surrounding the fire every single day. And it's exhausting. It's truly exhausting, you know, not only physical, because we still have all of our work that we need to do with our youth and families and continuing issues and the pandemic, but you're still having to have that piece that is dealing with paperwork or having properties cleaned or rebuilding. And I can only imagine I'm feeling this, what so many other people in the community that are in a much more vulnerable population have so much less, how they're feeling. It's very difficult to describe, but there's definitely not only a physical, but a mental aspect to it. There's times I just go home and I'm exhausted, just mentally and physically exhausted from dealing with it.
That was Beth Parsons, Chief Executive Officer for Youth for Change, speaking with NSPR's Christian Solis. As you just heard Parsons explain, issues around food insecurity and food access are complex and interconnected with so many other survivors are facing. In our last episode, we heard from campfire survivors we spoke with while they were picking up bags of groceries from a food relief distribution site that's been put on by the Food Bank of Contra Costa in Solano Counties ever since the first weekend after the fire. We'll turn again to NSPR's Christian Solis, who recently spoke with Lisa Rowling. She works on agency relations in the North State for the Food Bank and also lost her own home in the campfire. Like Parsons, Rowling expressed worry about survivors who were on the path to recovery and now, with COVID, have been set back.
For our direct distributions, we're seeing a lot of depression. Some of our participants are very honest about their depression. And between the campfire and COVID-19 and being out of work or just being at home, the quarantine. So the distributions, I believe, are just a kind chance for them to realize that there's people out there that care about them. It really is the only reason why I could think that they would be so honest about their depression or their sadness of the current situation.
What specific post-fire barriers are there to increasing food access and security in the burn scar?
Storage. Anybody that asks me this question, it's if we had storage ability to, between Feeding America and the other big donors that wanted to donate to us from the very beginning to this area, it would have been a different story. And we could have had more food stored a year and a half later, where right now everyone's looking at it as things are dwindling.
What efforts have been working to increase food security?
Just to be able to go somewhere and to a pantry or a distribution and to pick up food to help stretch your dollar. It's a wonderful feeling to know that there's people out there that still care and are doing what they can to help eliminate some of your struggle. At our direct distributions, if we've got two dinners that we're handing you and your family with some fresh produce, that gives you 2 days of reprieve from a constant battle that you're fighting.
Having survived the campfire yourself, what is the significance of continuing to serve your community a year and a half after the fire to you?
It's humbling. I'm proud. I'm very proud of what we do. I make sure that we know that the need is still here. I mean, part of it is me pushing and keeping track of the numbers and telling stories and making sure people still understand that Paradise is not, and Concow and the other areas affected by the campfire are not anywhere near being rebuilt.
When do you consider your job finished?
Because of Feeding America, Contra Costa's obligated to be in this area. If there's a food bank or a group that grows and can take on Feeding America, and then I'm just saying Feeding America because that's why I'm here. We would do that in a heartbeat because it's more efficient. It makes more sense to have everything in the North State under one food bank or one organization. If that happens and there's that ability, I would love that because our nonprofits in this area struggle constantly to obtain food. Contra Costa can only do so much. So at that point, I would not be needed and I would be okay with that. It would be a good thing for the community of the North State.
That was Lisa Rowling, who works on agency relations in the North State for the Food Bank of Contra Costa in Solano Counties, speaking with NSPR's Christian Solis. This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. Stay tuned.
Thank you. Support for NPR comes from this station and from C3. C3.ai software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai. And from iDrive, maker of remote PC, providing access to computers anywhere for remote assistance and work from home, featuring Remote PC Meeting, a video conference tool. More at remotepc.com. Support for NPR comes from this station and from DuckDuckGo, a privacy company committed to making privacy online simple. Used by millions, they offer private search and tracker blocking with one download. DuckDuckGo, privacy simplified. From Rock Auto, an online auto parts store with everything from complex electrical parts for modern daily drivers to new brake shoes for old favorites. More at rockauto.com. From the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and in developing countries, and working to inspire and enable the next generation of inventors. More information is available at lemelson.org. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. During the reporting for this project, there was one name that always seemed to come up when we were interviewing someone, the Magalia Community Church, often referred to as the MCC. The church has been providing survivors from all over the burn scar with food, clothes, furniture, and any other goods they might need for almost the entire length of recovery. Last January, I visited the church where I spoke with volunteer Doreen Fogel and Pastor Kevin Lindstrom, who at that time, more than a year into recovery, said food was still a huge issue.
Because it offsets the expense of getting gas to go to their doctor's appointments. Everything is in Chico now and so far away. And so by giving people food, then they'll be able to eat and still be able to buy the gas and the different things that they need. It's like we're not really a food store, but we're really able to supplement their food needs quite a bit.
It seems like it's all connected, housing and gas and food, because it's from the same budget. Can you kind of talk about that just a little bit more, what you're talking about?
One of the things that's happened, obviously, with Town of Paradise gone, and that means jobs have gone, doctors are gone, all of the facilities that you would use day to day are gone, and all the jobs are gone. So money is a real tight issue, especially as a lot of the FEMA money has run out. A lot of the insurance money has run out. And so they're really having to deal with, pull their belts into so much that at least by receiving food, you know, food is one of your biggest budgets in your life. So this way they're able to have a little money to make those other things that they need to buy.
One of the stories I saw recently on Facebook is somebody living in an RV. They don't have electricity yet, so they're depending upon a generator for their lighting and their heating for the RV. They said it's costing them $600 a month for gasoline for their generator. Now, clearly before the fire, they wouldn't be spending anywhere near that amount of money on heat or electricity. So that money's got to come from somewhere. So the only discretionary thing that they've got is food. And food is not really a discretionary item. Food is a necessity. So is heating, so is keeping warm. So it's like when you have to make that trade-off, especially if you've got young kids, it's like, how do you decide? How do you decide which is more important? You need to be warm, you need to have a safe place to live, and you need to have food.
One thing I wanted to touch on was you said, you know, in 6 months that there's still going to be a need.
Yeah, absolutely, there's still going to be a need in 6 months. Pastor Kevin and Shell, the office manager, went to a conference put on by IsraAid just a couple months ago, and they're predicting that the need is going to still be here for 3 years. And they said, as groups like ours decide we're no longer going to help, what happens is suicides go up, domestic violence goes up, people start dying more of strokes and heart attacks because of the increased stress, because they lose hope.
My philosophy is we will do this as long as there are volunteers, as long as the donations continue, and as long as the need is there. So If one of those things disappears, then we give up. But our goal is just to continue as long as those three things happen.
Now, that conversation was from months ago, before any of us knew we were going to be hit by a pandemic. So we recently reached out to the church again, speaking with them remotely about what's happening now. What's changed, they said? The pandemic has just made food insecurity worse and more extreme.
Because some people who had jobs before COVID don't have jobs now. So doing a need survey again right now, and we've only been doing it for 2 days this week, but food is the number one need that people are telling us again. That's the primary thing, is they're coming here for food. We still get brand new people coming in every single day. In terms of the overall numbers, I think the average right now is 37 families. That would be 160 families a week. And those families usually have between 3 and 7 people. So it's still, we're dealing with hundreds of people every single week.
And actually, our numbers are going up now since we announced that our tents are open again. Because during, when everything was shut down, we continued to hand out food, but we had closed the tent just for COVID safety. But now they're open again, and so we're seeing another big jump in our numbers.
Another question we also asked was when they thought their work would be done.
That's actually something we have been debating recently, because we just don't know. And I'm sad to say that one of the problems is we're a tiny church and we're running out of energy. And we're kind of running low on volunteers. And we've heard that the cash donations are coming to an end. So that's why I'm really praying, instead of just ending it, that they can get other churches to get involved and take over segments of it, instead of one place trying to do everything.
That was Pastor Kevin Lindstrom and volunteer Doreen Fogle of the Megalia Community Church. As you've heard in a few of the voices in this episode, food relief is not easy. And even those who have been doing it for a while are facing challenges in the aftermath of this fire and now during this pandemic. To learn more about some of those issues and about some possible solutions, I spoke with Tommy Dearmore, the Community Services Manager at the Community Action Agency of Butte County, which runs the North State Food Bank. One of the first things I asked was what the biggest barriers were in the burn scar at this point.
Enough trucks and fuel and volunteers to make that happen. We're getting quite a bit of food in right now, especially produce. The government, I believe it's through the CARES program, they're purchasing food from farmers. That never lasts forever. It comes in fits and starts. And so it's not like we don't need food, because we do, but it's the ability to get it into people's hands that is the difficulty. Since March, we have rented a 26-foot truck every day. We didn't have the capacity with our trucks and vehicles, so we've had to add this. We're in the process of purchasing a big truck, because it's really expensive to rent this thing. They charge by the day and mileage. And our service area is about 8,000 square miles, 5 counties. So that adds up pretty quick.
You know, you said one thing that you always need is food. What else could people do, you know, if they hear this and they want to help? What kinds of help could the food bank use?
Actually, money is probably the number one need. And the reason for that is because often we're faced with circumstances that the public wouldn't necessarily know about, just in the bigger picture of things. And sometimes well-meaning folks want to buy things and give it to the food bank, which is great. But I'll give you an example. Right after the campfire, this fellow went out and he spent quite a bit of his own money buying diapers and wanted to bring them to us. And we had just received a bunch of diapers from a diaper bank. Had he just donated the money in the first place, we could have put it to use purchasing food or maybe fuel for the truck or some other need. We're grateful for it, but oftentimes it doesn't doesn't quite fit in what we need in the moment.
What gaps might there still be between resources and the people receiving those resources, specifically for campfire survivors? I mean, are they aware of all of the resources that are available to them, and do those resources fit their needs at this point?
I'm not quite sure what the information gap is, but oftentimes I get phone calls and I refer people to 211 and they had never heard of 211. And 211 is awesome. I mean, it's really a one-stop shop for resources in this area, and I think we could do a better job of making people aware of that.
Another thing I just wanted to touch on, because you brought this up, and also just from conversations I've had with campfire survivors, do you think one of the issues is a lack of enough people working on this? Just because, you know, you can only hire as many people as you can pay for. That's one thing that seems to happen where it's like we have these resources, but we just need more people.
Yeah, absolutely. For instance, 211, I mentioned a moment ago, really has all the resources for these folks at their fingertips. But a lot of times you call 211, you can't get through. You know, they've only got so many people working the phones. So resources and places that are like clearinghouses for these resources, they all need people. If folks wanted to volunteer, I think that would be a great place to do a good service to this community.
The other thing I wanted to talk to you about was when we spoke in January, I believe you had talked about an emergency food plan for the county, and that at the time of the fire, we did not have one. Do we have one now? Is that something that is being worked on at this point?
You know, I don't believe it is. I think that that would be helpful if there was, and not just with food, but in times of disaster, if there could be some kind of clearinghouse or some information hub so that people who wanted to donate, who wanted to volunteer, who had goods and services available could go through this, and then it could be allocated appropriately around the area. I saw a lot of duplication of services after the campfire, and people were working hard and really doing great things, but oftentimes they were stepping over each other, and meanwhile, pockets of people here and there weren't getting anything.
That was Tommy Dearmore, the Community Services Manager at the Community Action Agency of Butte County. If there's one thing you take away from this episode, I hope it's that there are a lot of people working on this issue. In fact, many more organizations are working on it than could fit in this episode. But even with all of those people helping, there is so much more that needs to be done, especially in more rural parts of the burn scar, which we'll be visiting next. This has been the third of 5 episodes on hunger in the campfire burn scar. This series was produced by Christian Solis and Sarah Bohannon as a project for the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism Impact Fund. Thanks to Eric Rodeville and Kylo Castilla for additional editing support. Our technical producer is Matt Fidler. Thank you for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, News Director at North State Public Radio, and this is Special Coverage. Tune in each weekday evening at 6:30 or catch the rebroadcast the following morning at 8:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and stay tuned.